one of the reasons we're talking is that I had been going through basically the complete history of the New York Times Siena poll. I was, you know, in particular, just looking like, has anything changed about Method over the course of, you know, 7 years or whatever? And the interesting thing there was mostly after about, you know, four or five of these, I went, hang on, what's an L2 voter file? And so this is how I found you guys.
Welcome to Crosstabs, the podcast that tries to explain how polls are designed and conducted, who they include, who they leave out, what they say and what they don't say, so you can better navigate yet another most important election year in history. I'm your host, Farah Bostic, founder of The Difference Engine, an insights-driven strategy consultancy helping leaders make big decisions. Each episode, we take a look at the art and science of polling. No takes, no spin, no predictions. This time, we have help from Paul Westcott, Executive Vice President at L2, one of the biggest suppliers of voter file data to some of the biggest surveys you come across in the news. He sat down a few weeks ago with me to talk about what the voter file is, how pollsters use it, and why it's about a lot more than just your name, address, and party ID. So let's dig in.
My name's Paul Westcott. I'm Executive Vice President at L2. In my capacity, I oversee all of our sales, marketing, as well as operations and digital efforts and partnerships. So a lot of different elements of the company.
How long have you been doing this kind of work?
I'm coming up on 10 years with L2, so almost a full decade.
And is this your kind of area of interest? Is this your background, or is it kind of a shift for you in your career?
Well, my career started actually in media. So I worked right out of college. I worked for NBC News as an assignment editor and a researcher at the network desk. And that was fun, but it was overnights and a lot of challenging, stressful work. So I moved on to working in another form of media, working for digital, but under iHeartMedia, where I was a national editor for all of their radio station websites. So that was another, you know, change in the career, but still in sort of the news and editorial vein. But my degree was in political science, and I was like, I was very always been interested in politics, but didn't really want to run a campaign. And then an opportunity came up with this political data company, L2, and, you know, from everything I knew about data, it's not going anywhere. So I join on as director of marketing, and, you know, here we are 10 years later, and I'm helping to run the company with our CEO.
So L2 has an interesting history. Maybe you can talk us through a little bit how the company came to be, where it came from.
Yeah, L2 started as Labels and Lists. So you can see why we changed the name. And so Labels and Lists started around 1970. And it was started by our current CEO's mother-in-law. She's now passed, but she was the one who founded the company, basically realizing that the Washington State voter file, where she was, you know, working on campaigns and working with candidates, realized that that voter file was awful. It was in bad shape. People were deceased. People had moved, all of that. So there was a demand for this. And it was a very small demand, but there was a demand for it to have a sort of a cleaned up version of this file. So she launched Labels and Lists. And she basically started in Washington State and over the years expanded to Illinois, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, other states like that. And then in the mid-80s, our current CEO, Bruce Wilsey, her son-in-law, took over the company, and out of our, at the time, Bellevue, Washington office, basically continued to print labels and lists. And by labels, I mean mailing labels that got put on by, and I'm making a hand motion here, but like a stamp printer that would stamp envelopes. And then the lists are walk lists. So lists you would use for canvassing.
Having done some of that walking plats, knocking on doors over the years, you know, my parents did a little bit of that. So we got dragged along too. I remember those.
Sure.
I remember the lists. And you still get paper lists sometimes, depending on who you're canvassing with. What is it that states have in terms of their voter rolls? Because one thing we know is not every state requires you to register with a political party in order to vote. And so they may not even know what your kind of political affiliation is based on just the data they have on your voter registration card. What is the information that government has about voters in general?
Yeah, sure. It's actually pretty interesting. And I've got a book on my shelf behind me here talking about some of the early voter rolls. And it included things going back to 1900, including a person's weight, their race and ethnicity. It had lots of eye color, things like that, these weird in-depth things. There's a great book about it by Eitan Hersh, who goes through sort of the history of the voter file. So if you really want to nerd out, you can definitely go into that.
Right.
But looking, you know, a few hundred years later, we've obviously changed, and states and counties have gone through different regulatory changes in how the voter file is provided and what information comes with it. We do not get social security numbers. That is not part of the voter file. It really is a baseline file of name and address. Starting there, it does give registration date in almost every case, if not every case. It gives the date. It gives additional information on vote history, of course, and that varies. Some states are very limited. They give the last election or last two elections. Some go back decades in some cases, so that'll vary. Party identification is provided in some states, and we can go into more depth about, you know, how states do it. The majority of states still provide it based on party affiliation, so you affiliate with Republican or Democrat, and you appear as that in the rolls. Some states have it where you're getting the primary ballot selection of your last election. So if you walk in and say Virginia and say, I want to be a Democrat today and pull a Democratic primary ballot, you're flagged as a Democrat in their file. Does it mean you're a Democrat? In most cases, yes. But in some cases, you know, it's simply the primary ballot they selected. The next piece of it would be things like age or date of birth, although some states have started to phase that out. Several states by law under the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act have to provide race and ethnicity data. These are mostly states throughout the Southeast, South Carolina, North Carolina, Florida, Texas, etc. And those states do provide some degree, it varies, but some degree of racial and ethnic coding, primarily around, you know, African Americans, as well as Native Americans, although we get typically everything. So we incorporate that with some of our racial and ethnic modeling.
So it's really kind of as ever in this country, a patchwork. And I can start to guess why some of those states have certain levels of detail that others don't, and why in the 1900s you might have other kinds of identifying data that we wouldn't bother to collect now. So that is, you know, kind of good as far as it goes, right? It tells you who's registered to vote. I think there are a lot of branches we can go off down here. But what do campaigns actually need besides name, whether you voted before, address, in order to organize their campaigns, do door knocking, do outreach, send mailers, all of the kinds of things that campaigns do? What other kinds of information are needed, and how does L2 sort of help them bridge that gap?
Yeah, I mean, and this has evolved. Even in the last decade, we've seen this sort of evolve. And, you know, talking about sort of the history of using lists or using data, you have, you know, famous examples are Karl Rove utilizing sort of NRA lists or local church affiliation lists. That was a big one. And then, of course, the Obama campaign famously, you know, building out an analytics program in a way that no one had done it before in 2008. So you have, you know, this sort of history of it. And we look back on those programs now and kind of snicker because it's like it was so rudimentary and it wasn't that long ago. But in this period of time, what we've seen is, you know, even down ballot campaigns move from saying, I just need names and addresses for my municipality, for my council district, which some still do. Some still just simply rely on that, and they want to knock on every door and mail every person. And maybe they'll incorporate phones, so they'll do like hand-dialed phone calls at their house, or they'll use a program to do it. But that's really the extent of some campaigns. Now, that's sort of the base level. L2, of course, provides the phone number. So that's something I would say for that level of campaigning that they would utilize, as well as the cleanup on that existing file, removing people who have died or moved out of the state or district. So we've got that, you know, sort of basic hygiene. Then you've got the next level. And the next level basically starts to come into, okay, so what else would you need to be able to do targeting or modeling? And the targeting and modeling that a lot of these organizations do, obviously, they're gonna be focused around party identification, vote history. Vote history, for anybody who does data or big data as you know, work and is listening to this, I can tell you they probably are a little jealous of the voter file because there's an action that you have that somebody took on some date, and we have that recorded, and we have it recorded over a long period of time. So I can tell you Jane Smith at 123 Main Street went and voted in this year, and she voted early in this year, and she voted, you know, in person in this year. So you have a whole history of this person's likely actions that they're going to take. And then you can basically say, without doing any complex modeling, say this person on this date did this, so therefore they're likely to do it again in this upcoming election. So that I think is sort of the core of what people are pulling from. However, we've gone far beyond that now and have moved into things like racial and ethnic coding that we've done across the whole file. And this isn't just sort of top line, you know, East and South Asian, Hispanic, you know, white and black. It's really quite a bit more going in depth. So you can target Vietnamese voters. So you could, you know, break down Arab voters. So you could break down different voters of different backgrounds. And, you know, depending on the issues of the day, there's, you know, different groups are going to matter more or going to, you're going to want to speak to them. Then you've got things like consumer data and other sort of underlying data that you would find in the census, but also in commercial files. There's a ton of commercially available data here. And the biggest thing that we've taken on is sort of linking those commercially available data back to the voter file. So basically saying, okay, well, what's somebody's income, their education level? How does somebody spend their time? What hobbies and interests do they have? And all these things kind of tell stories about these people. The Washington Post did a piece utilizing our data a few years back, talking about how boat owners are almost entirely Trump supporters. It's an odd connection, but they were able to make it because we have the commercial data, and I would have never thought to do it, but they did that. So there's all these things that, you know, people can utilize to basically be able to find individuals beyond that sort of core voter information in the consumer realm, as well as donors, which we take and append from the FEC data, as well as state level donor data. And then we build models on top of that.
So I think, like, I'm going to be the total naif here and just sort of ask some probably very rudimentary questions. And so some of the things that I think might come up for an average person interested in this sort of thing is the difference between, like, if I were to ask this, you know, Secretary of State's office for the state of New York for the New York voter file, maybe I could get it. Maybe I couldn't. I mean, every state's sort of different in how open those records are, and how many hoops you have to jump through to get them, and also how expensive they are to obtain. But let's say I could. If they're only publishing the last year or the last, you know, the last election or the last two elections, let's say, voter behavior, one of the benefits of what you guys can do is you're kind of continuously pulling voter files and able to sort of track it back further. And the reason that this matters is we have this, you know, distinction that that pollsters frequently draw between a registered voter and a likely voter. And one of the determinations of a likely voter is how frequently they vote. You know, how many of the last four, six, whatever elections have they participated in as voters? And so maybe talk a bit about that part of it, like the kind of continuous collection, essentially, of not continuous, but, you know, some sort of wave collection to be able to keep track of longitudinal voter behavior. Because I think one of the questions I get from listeners is just sort of like, how do you know what a likely voter is? How do you figure that out? So one of the things is, have you voted before? Do you consistently vote? Do you vote both in general elections and midterms? Do you vote in off years? Do you vote in specials? All of those things are, you know, the more you do all of those things, the more I know for sure you're going to vote, barring like being hit by a truck. You are going to go vote one way or the other, right? And increasingly, that won't stop you either. You'll get your vote by mail situation sorted out and figure it out. Maybe talk a bit about how you work with those sort of state-provided records about voter participation.
Working with the states is one of the more challenging parts of our operation. We have a wonderful staffer named Leanna, she and her team are the ones who collect all the files. And what we look for when we're hiring somebody for that position is someone, quite frankly, who can be very nice, very polite, very patient, because you're dealing with people whose sole job is not to cater to voter file providers or even political campaigns. Their whole job is to make sure that a voter roll exists so it can be checked by election workers and to fulfill state mandates on maintaining voter records. So we happen to have this voter file that's useful. And I always remind the team whenever we bring somebody on for this, that that's their main purpose. So you got to give them a little slack. We're not going to hit them over the head and say, you have to give us this file now, because they'll wait to the very end of their statutory authority, allowing them to wait the full 30 days, which has happened. So within each state, we are collecting the data 4 to 6 times per year for almost every state, which is a lot. Way more aggressive than we used to be. There just is a greater demand for these data at a higher cadence, so our faster cadence. So we are trying to keep up with that. That primarily is to get in, obviously, recent election data, history data, but also new registrants. So those are sort of the two big things.
That is particularly interesting because I think one of the things that keeps coming up in some of our interviews is the difficulty of modeling someone who is newly registered, that does not have a vote record. But also, if your model is a year old and they just registered in the last 6 months, they're not going to be in your model at all, much less, figuring out how much weight to give them in terms of probability of turnout and that sort of thing. So that's super interesting that you're collecting on that pace. But carry on.
Absolutely. And that's one of the big challenges. You talk about sort of that longitudinal string of information that we have. Obviously, we start with the voter file. But in order to model on a new registrant, you really have to look, you can't look at their vote behavior. So you have to look at their, their race and ethnicity, their age, their gender, their income, all these things. Are they a homeowner? Do they have kids? Do they live in the suburbs or do they live in a city? And all these things start to paint a picture. And as I say these words, I'm sure you're imagining, oh, okay, this person's a Democrat, this person's a Republican. There's a lot of, quantitative elements that go into this as, analytics firms use. But When you're talking about, the data collection element, though, you have some states, like you mentioned, just going back to that, some states like South Carolina, for example, they give you 1 or 2 years of vote history. That's it. So we fortunately have been collecting there for decades. So we have a history of it, which is great. But if you want, to know how somebody voted, even in the 2020 general election or primary election in South Carolina, you actually have to come to us or another provider. Because the state doesn't maintain it, or if they do, they're not going to sell it to you. So that's part of it. Some states also, there's a cost difference. So Alabama costs around $34,000 to obtain the state of Alabama. Wisconsin's $15,000, whereas Pennsylvania is $40. Ohio is free. It's online. So, it's a wide variety of different things. And then you run into other issues with states such as in New England, Massachusetts, Maine, Vermont, and New Hampshire all have town-based election systems. So you don't have counties. So in New York, you could go to Suffolk County and you could reliably get a Suffolk County voter file. In New Hampshire or Maine or, those other states, you have to go to each of the towns to collect it to build together that file. So
America.
It's that rugged independence that makes things so challenging. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's even interesting that even primaries are not kind of apples to apples in terms of the way that they're structured and held. And I was sort of like a little bit, I mean, this is kind of embarrassing because I too have a political science undergraduate degree and a law degree, and I took election law. And yet I was still like, oh, right. There are elections that are not held by the states. They're held by the parties. And that's what caucuses are. And it was just sort of this like, right. And, not everybody after 1970 decided to get on board with this primary system with committed delegates and all of that sort of thing. Everybody's got their own little way of doing things. So it's just very fun. I hadn't even thought about that. Feels very New England to me to have everything managed at the township level. That's adorable. But wow, what an endeavor for you guys to collect all of that and to do so at the kind of pace that you have to do it at in order to provide legible data for campaigns and others.
Well, and that's why in 2017, we released what we call the uniform format. And it was such a big deal because to create uniformity over something that is so disparate and unique, almost on the municipal level, in some cases all the way up to the whole country, it's tough to do. And so we were very proud, and our CEO and CTO and our engineering team really did a magnificent job of saying, okay, how do we standardize this so we could create one single uniform national table? And it has been, it's part of the reason we've been so successful with researchers and others. So if you just go, even LexisNexis or any Google academic, and look up L2 voter file, you will see hundreds, if not thousands, of papers using our file because of the fact that we created this uniform template, and now it's, you know, coming up on 7-8 years old. So people are able to go back in time and be able to build out profiles on individuals across sort of a standardized voter file, where we said, okay, even though in odd years, the Chicago mayoral general election takes place in May or June, we're going to call that a general election, and basically bucketing and figuring out, you know, who goes where. New York sometimes has upwards of 3 different primaries in 1 year, which is bizarre.
I am an election worker here in Suffolk County. And so, yes, I'm aware.
Yes.
Kind of like, we need you here at the fire station at 5 a.m. 4 times this year.
And it's confusing as to why you are. But these states, they all have their own rules about it. And so what we tried to do was to say, okay, let's make it so it's more standardized and, you know, built around that, which, again, is no easy feat, especially because you're getting different information from different places. Some places in those New England towns provide age. Some don't. That's just their choice.
Wow. This is one of the things about some of the folks I know for sure who listened to this, is I think they will find this actually kind of inspiring, because they are frequently struggling with normalizing data and structuring unstructured data and trying to put things into any kind of queryable format that can be used. And as a qualitative researcher, structuring unstructured data is basically my life's work. The other part of this, I think, is the kind of enrichment of the raw data that you're able to get from the states or the towns, the counties, about who's voted, who's registered. And so maybe talk a bit about how you are able to append the voter file with information about race or income or consumer behavior and any of those kinds of additional, maybe let's start with just the demographic stuff where it's not standard. Where does that come from?
So race and ethnicity is one of our most interesting attributes, and it's one that's it's become more heavily scrutinized in recent years as to how individuals do it. Is it being used properly? Obviously, we believe our use case for political purposes is being used correctly under, you know, First Amendment protections for political speech. But at the end of the day, race and ethnicity, ethnic coding used to just be census-based or surname-based. That was it. So they would take one or the other, or maybe work with a little bit of both. We, in past years, have met and worked with a researcher named Kosuke Amai, who worked out of Princeton University for years, knew our CEO very well, and recently went to Harvard University and has published numerous papers on this in Nature and other publications, but basically talking about using a combination of given names, surname, and census data all to come up with ethnic coding, which is not simply, you know, white, black, Hispanic. It's a little bit more complex than that, in that what we look for in building out our ethnic coding is, we don't call people, you know, white, for example, it's European. So you'll say European, and then we'll have subgroups of Irish, Welsh, English, Italian, etc. So you have all that, and we'll do that for each of the major, what we call broad ethnic codings. And using the given names is something that would seem like a common sense thing, but very few people do it. I was working with a group in Texas who was working with one of the party files that they had, which does it based on census data. And Jerry Jones, who owns the Dallas Cowboys, it was coded as black. And there was no reason, rhyme or reason for that, but it was just kind of a funny example of somebody being totally miscoded just because they took either census data or likely a surname table and just said Jones, probably a black person. So they coded like that. So using the given names, using the census data all in combination can tell you, okay, well, this is a very low probability that this individual is living in a neighborhood with other African Americans. So therefore, we're going to code this person as white.
Yeah. Also, just not a lot of black owners of NFL teams, but.
Right. Right. And it's like, and within the neighborhood in Highland Park where Jerry Jones lives and all of that, I mean, it's a pretty, I immediately went to our file, looked it up and said, okay. Another was a staffer for the mayor of Houston. So another Texas example. They said, I live in a neighborhood of all Hispanics and I am white, and there's no way you're going to have me coded properly. Nobody has me coded properly. And we did. And again, it was because we had his name coded correctly, you know, using the given names, not just relying on census based data. So it gives you a level of precision with it. It's never 100%, but it gives you a much better level of precision in that kind of coding.
That's so interesting. you know, my business is primarily, you know, market research, but we do have some experience with looking at, we'll use ArcGIS and other tools like that to look at, you know, the kind of geographical incidence of different demographic targets. Where do we find, you know, 35-year-old second generation Hispanic women who are thinking about getting a bachelor's degree or whatever? And there's quite a bit of very useful information that you can overlay that's just from the census and the, what is it, the American Community Survey that they do in addition to the census. Like, that information becomes incredibly useful for finding out who's a homeowner, who's a renter. And you're not pinpointing it down to the person necessarily. You're giving it a probability that the person who lives within that, you know, census map area is going to be one or the other. But it's very interesting to think about all of those combinations. Now I'm curious about how I'm coded, because I have this Persian first name, a last name that is frequently mistaken for being Slavic when it's actually a misspelling for 250 years of an English last name. And I live in a pretty Hispanic area in Suffolk County, but surrounded by a ton of really rich white people. So it could go any way, could be cut any particular direction. So what I want to kind of shift to is when a, set aside campaigns for a minute, when a pollster or an academic, whether a, you know, media pollster or academic institution, wants to use the L2 voter file for their polls, why? Why do they want that? How do they reach out to you? Maybe just kind of walk us through how that works.
Yeah, absolutely. There's really two major methodologies among media pollsters and even, you know, other political researchers, which are going to be a voter file based, which has become sort of the more popular method, and then RDD, or random digit dialing, which, you know, you use basically a phone file of any given area that you're looking to reach, which basically just takes all phone numbers. So what we provide with the voter file and what they'd want to work with, and I'll do a little bragging here, you know, New York Times uses us, and that's a relationship that goes back to 2014 when Nate Cohn tweeted, he said, "Does anybody have a 2012 North Carolina voter file?" And I immediately replied to him. I said, "I do." In their inventory. And wow. He got right back to me. And from there, he goes, "Oh my gosh, I didn't know this existed," yeah. Or this from about L2. He obviously knows about voter files. But so the relationship grew from there. And obviously working with, you know, one of the leading publications on earth, it was very helpful. And, you know, us working then with the Wall Street Journal and ABC and CBS and all the other great researchers that are out there in the media space, using voter file information. Now, some use it for the baseline demographics. Some utilize it for planning and plotting where they're going to put exit pollsters to say this precinct is representative of a given area. And some use it, of course, for direct contact for polls. So you have all those different things, and that's mixed modal. They'll use it for, you know, calls, landline calls or IVR calls, you know, automated calls. They'll use it for texting, you know, the cell phone file. They'll even use the email file through different platforms for that kind of research. So there's all kinds of different ways to utilize the data. If they want it, they simply have to, and this goes for anybody who's looking to utilize an L2 file, they have to just talk to a member of our team, because we go through a qualification process, because we're very protective of the voter file. There's maybe 5 providers in the whole country that do this for the whole country. And, you know, there's a lot of charlatans in the data space, as I'm sure everybody listening knows. So we're very careful about maintaining our reputation and making sure that this data doesn't get into the hands of somebody who it shouldn't be. So not just pick on any, you know, one domain type, but when we see a .ru, you know, at the end of an email, we get a little bit hesitant, as we don't sell the file internationally. So we do look for things like that.
It's important data. It is, you know, the basics of it are public data. And yet it's also kind of, it is appended and enriched and made more usable and useful. And so therefore you would want to protect it a little bit, vet who's asking for it and understand what they intend to do with it. So that's quite interesting. But I think one of the things I'm curious about, this will be a little bit more research nerdy, is when they say that they're using the L2 voter file, are they essentially getting some kind of list out of the L2 voter file to recruit from for the surveys? Or are they doing random digit dialing and then like I've done a study where we just did a baseline recruit, but then verified with the voter file. I didn't get involved in that part of it. My quantitative partners did. So I don't know what service they used for that. But and it was just in Pennsylvania. But I'm just curious about kind of the order of operations there. Are they essentially recruiting based on lists they get through the voter file, or are they recruiting and then verifying that these are voters with the vote histories that they have and using some of that data you have to do their analysis? Which way does the cart and the horse go?
Yeah, I mean, so my understanding of it, and I'm going to speak almost as an outsider here. I mean, we have a window in, obviously. We speak with them frequently because they are dialing more numbers probably than anyone we know. I mean, they do a lot of polling. But I believe working with Siena and their call center, they essentially are dialing all of these numbers from the voter file, and they use the voter file essentially as a reference point. They are asking for party ID. They're asking to confirm names, things like that, even things that we're providing with the voter file. They are among the more rigorous researchers who we've worked with, in that they do, instead of using and leaning too heavily on the file, they are asking those questions up front and using the file almost as a secondary check on that information that they're getting. And I do believe it's all calls, but based purely on the voter file. I don't think they're doing RDD unless they're incorporating that in some other piece of the methodology that I don't know. But from my understanding, it's all voter file based.
So that's got to be quite a pull of data given response rates these days on any kind of market research or political polling. The response rates, as Pew and others have documented, is in the basement.
Yeah.
But to get to 1,000 completes, you got to start with a lot of numbers to call. And I'm just curious about, like, that feels like that's got to get expensive.
Yeah, it does. And that's why we do have a lot of conversations with them about it in terms of phone quality and ensuring that we're giving them only the best available numbers and things like that. And, you know, constantly cleaning our files. You know, it's response rates. It has gotten extremely tough to get people on the phone. It used to be, you know, you would have, when I started at L2, we had more landlines than we did cell phones. That was just the reality of it. And that was 2014. That whole script has flipped in that we have three times the number of cell phones than we do landline numbers. And it's become far more challenging to get even the 65 plus individuals on the phone, which is why, you know, mixed modal outreach has become the norm now in utilizing emails, but really a lot of text messaging, particularly those from 18 to 40. You know, that's become a huge window of people, which I'm still hanging on to, you know, in that group for text messaging. Soon I'll be getting calls. But, you know, at the end of the day, they, you know, it's texting and then hand dialed cell phone calls. And then if you're really pushing it, landline calls as well. And that's, we've seen that kind of methodology be the best, the most efficient, but even that is requiring tens or hundreds of thousands of numbers, which is why for media researchers, we took kind of a different tact, as well as academic researchers, in that we offer a special license for the whole file. So we provide them with the entire nationwide voter file. So they're actually able to access as many numbers as they need at any point in time. So they're not worried about data cost and continually having to come back to the well and get more numbers and more numbers. I mean, the non-media researchers we work with are very smart, and they know to buy 3X or 4X or 6X or whatever it is for their, you know, for their calls.
I mean, obviously, the smaller the geographic area or the more specific the audience you want to do research with, the smaller the necessary sample in order to get something that you can have good confidence in. Conversation I have with clients all the time. Like, that's a really homogeneous and very niche audience. We don't need 1,000 of them in order to survey them. And so that is super interesting. One of the critiques I have heard from polling, you know, well, pollsters and research companies that do a lot of internal research work for campaigns, is that the media and academic partnership, or just media pollsters, are doing it on the cheap. And I mean, I probably, it's a question I ought to put to the media pollsters of, like, what do they mean exactly? But I'm sure it doesn't feel cheap to them. But do you have a sense of, like, the difference in approach and therefore the expense of how the Biden campaign would go about doing this kind of work versus, you know, New York Times, Siena, or Marist, or anybody else?
Yeah, I think, you know, nobody's doing it on the cheap at this point. There's no way to do it on the cheap, essentially. I would say they are able to get better access to things because they're media or academic researchers, and that they have a student population who can do the calls as paid for by the university through work study programs and things like right. that. I've heard that complaint quite a bit. The other piece, obviously, is the voter file side, or getting the actual underlying data. As I said, we do a special deal and work special licenses with these organizations. It's not that much cheaper, but it's a little bit, mm-hmm. and, you know, hopefully gives them the ability to do more of these calls more reliably. You know, I think it really comes down to methodology, and that should be probably the bone that they're really picking, not mm-hmm. as much about cost. You know, it's, are you looking at likely voters or all voters? And, right. you know, a few years back, you know, the New York Times in particular focused around trying to reach, I think it was like 100,000 people in every congressional district among the most competitive districts that were out there. Which is huge. That's, you know, yeah. a quarter of the voters in some districts. And so yeah. you're dealing with a huge sample that they were trying to collect. And it was really interesting. And they put out the sort of raw information that they were pulling from. So that is something you would never see a campaign do, as far yeah. as I could tell. No. They would be far more focused on, you know, making sure the sample is weighted properly, and they're getting the correct, you know, they're oversampling women, or they're oversampling Hispanics in certain areas, or whatever mm-hmm. whatever it might be. And they're needling things that are much more specific, in addition to looking at likely voters versus, you know, the total voting population. So I think mm-hmm. that's going to be your biggest differentiator, and it's where, you know, especially if your numbers are not what you hope them to be publicly, those that's when they get a little angrier.
Yeah. So I'm curious about what else has kind of evolved about your approach, or the data you collect, or the way that you structure it over the last 8-10 years, given things like you've got the diminished response rates, which has been happening for a long time. You've got people not having landlines in some mm-hmm. places. You've got an increased interest, it feels like, really since kind of 2016, in almost like understanding unlikely voters, you know, the people that are a little bit more wild cardy. And I think also these desires to understand more in depth these demographic subgroups of either party's base or of just the voting population. What are some other kind of trends that have been changing the way that you guys approach things, or things that you see changing in the way that any kind of pollster wants to interact with the voter file?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're seeing, obviously, a lot more reliance on some of the core fields in the voter file, obviously, because the number of completes is harder and harder to get. So if you're reliant on fulfilling an entire survey, if you need 100% response on 100% of the questions, that's going to get challenging. So trying to lean on L2 or other providers to make sure I'm using, you know, their party ID, I'm using their, you know, name, I'm using this other stuff to get the meat and potatoes that you want to be able to get out of, you know, the questions. I think that's definitely, or the response.
So I can skip all the survey questions I would waste asking yep. you your age and your income and your ethnicity and that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And we even saw, I mean, again, going back to the New York Times, I mean, it was a big deal when they said, we're going to take partial responses. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, that was a big change for them, that they were, you know, trying to complete entire surveys. That's a very hard thing to do this day and age. And even for somebody, I'm a patient guy, and I understand what corporate researchers are doing. So I actually got on a medical research, I guess it was part of it wasn't a panel, but I was answering questions, and I was there, and it was fine until I think I was on the 130th question, to which I finally said, I have other things to do. I got to go. And like, I'm hoping they took those first 129 responses. But yeah, I mean, I think limiting the number of questions, I've seen quite heavily, you know, us including additional identifiers for people has been a big thing. So obviously cell phones, big one, landlines, big one, but a lot of including IP addresses, mobile ad IDs, incorporating some of the digital elements in there to be able to identify matching an individual back. So you serve them ads and hope that individual, particularly around IP addresses, to try to get somebody to do an online survey who's at the very least in a neighborhood or a zip code that you want to be able to target, and to fill out a survey using a combination of sort of panel data matched to voter file information, as mm-hmm. well as respondent data that's outside the panel. That's been another big one as well. But yeah, I mean, just adding new fields all the time. I mean, we're looking at things like, you know, in-depth occupation data. We really don't want to wade into HIPAA or medical information, but that's been, there's been a lot of requests to get those kinds of things, mostly on the, you know, the campaign outreach side, but really to find people mm-hmm. who have, you know, some kind of medical condition or might be on a program, therefore, you know, would be a potential voter or donor or supporter of some kind. So
interesting. I mean, it's also just when I first entered the market research business, it was fairly typical to screen out anybody on the employment question who said that they were on disability.
Right.
And I honestly couldn't really tell you why we did that, but we did. And now, because we do so much work remotely, it doesn't really matter. Like, if you, in all other respects, are a consumer in this category, what do I care if you're on disability or not? And also, like, it doesn't affect my ability to talk to you because you can get on a Zoom call just as well as anybody else. And you can take an online survey just as well as anybody else. And it's interesting to think about some of, you know, I think increased awareness of, I saw a stat from, I think, the CDC that was estimating, it's a big, wide range. They don't have great data on it, but something between 25 and 40% of Americans have a disability or a long-term condition. So actually being interested in how that might play on people's political preferences is also quite interesting. So the other thing I wanted to ask you about is, what's the difference between when I see in the, you know, methodology appendix of a pollster, L2 voter file versus L2 model? What's the distinction there?
The L2 voter file is going to be the voter file. That's really right. More based on, yes, it's our commercially available data, meaning L2's data, where we do weed out people who have died or who have moved mm-hmm. out of that state. So it is the L2 file. However, it's reliance on known party identification. Usually that's going to be the most commonly used. Sometimes the ethnic coding, where they'll use the state ethnic coding versus L2s. So if it's a known actual piece of data from the voter file, that's going to be the L2 file. When you're talking about modeled, that's when it's going to be party identification almost always is going to be modeled, you know, based on our modeling that we do in those states that don't provide it with the file.
So are pollsters kind of coming in with a idea about what the makeup of a representative electorate would be and then using the model to construct their sample in that way?
Yes, they'll do that. But, you know, depending on what the poll is and, you know, who they're looking to speak to, obviously a primary poll is very different than a general poll. So if you're looking at, you know, primary voters, Democratic primary voters, what you can do, there's two ways to do it. One is you take the L2 model Democrats, you take known Democrats if they have that, and then you take the primary ballot selection of that individual. Now, are you going to take one? Are you going to take the last 10 years? Are you going to take the last 20 years? So that's the question that the pollster or researcher has to ask themselves. Most are going to say this person is a likely primary voter, and we split that into categories based on which ballot they pulled. If that information's available, there's two or three states, Hawaii, Washington, Minnesota. They don't provide any of that. So we're doing it modeled entirely. So they have to trust us, or they simply have to do it as a screener question and say, okay, this is a Democratic primary poll. Are you a Democrat? And they need the person to self-identify.
That's super interesting. And now you are also continuing to come up with interesting ways of making this data usable and available and have some really interesting partnerships with Snowflake and other things. Maybe talk a bit about what that's all about and how you're approaching those partnerships.
When I started again, it was a different landscape in that we had, you know, our data was available via a flat file and a secure FTP, and then our data mapping tool at the time was called Voter Mapping. And that tool essentially is a, you know, a GIS web-based tool. You can log into it, pull counts, things like that. It's a query tool, and then you can purchase and download data. So that was basically it. That's where we had it available. Then in 2015, I got introduced to somebody at a company called LiveRamp, and LiveRamp has, of course, exploded into a sort of a globally dominant identity graph / onboarding platform to allow offline files like the voter file to go online, do online targeting, mostly cookie-based, but they're starting to incorporate other identifiers. And I had to learn about all that. But essentially, what that became was a new platform for which the data was available that we looked at and said, is this, you know, the first couple of years wasn't a huge deal. And now it's a massive part of our business. I would say we're looking at Snowflake and Google BigQuery and some of the others that are out there as sort of the next the next iteration of that, which is people want to be able to work with the data in a clean room environment, which mm-hmm. basically means they can do it in an anonymized way, in a privacy secure way, and be able to query these data without having to onboard it locally, mm-hmm. which has been one of the biggest challenges for some of our nationwide file holders, is saying, how are we going to ingest all this? Just simply mm-hmm. dumping it into a CRM isn't going to work. Trying to even put it into something like Access, which, believe it or not, people have tried to do. I'm like, that doesn't work either. They're like, I can't open this. I'm like, well, yeah, it's, 213 yeah. million records and 700 rows or 700 columns. So it's just not going to work.
Goodness.
So having platforms that allow you to write simple SQL queries, you don't have to host it locally. You don't have to have a SQL instance yourself, and they make it easy. Snowflake is, in my opinion, it's the leader in the industry mm-hmm. at this moment, but there's lots of them out there. And our goal is to be on every single one of those.
That's amazing. So my last question for you is one I've been putting to everyone I've interviewed so far, which is, what's something that you find from where you sit and the work that you do, kind of public commentators, ordinary folks, get wrong about how polling works?
I think more people should do what you've done, which is read the methodology. It's not written in complex terms. It really isn't. It's very simple, and it lays out, it's all about talking to people and getting responses. And I remember when I learned this, I'm like, oh, it was like opened up a whole new world for me to basically understand how these polls are actually done. It's not people guessing. It's not some black box. They want you to know their methodology, and they mm-hmm. write about it. And they write these long summaries, basically, of everything they did, how they contacted people. And, pollsters work incredibly hard to get this right. They want to be right. And I go to conferences like APOR, mm-hmm. which I'm sure you've been to, and, the Association of Public Opinion Researchers. And there is panel after panel of people going, how do we improve this methodology to be more correct? They have no other goal in their head. They don't want to be partisan. I'm sure there's some that are out there that their goal is to be partisan. They're asking push yep. questions and all those things. But at the end of the day, most researchers you're going to see publicly that are listed on Real Clear Politics or 538 or any of those other places, they're going to be, or ranked, they're going to be the ones that are quality pollsters, that their goal is to be right, mm-hmm. left, right, or center. So read the methodology and just know that they actually are working with best intentions.
Well, Paul, thank you for taking the time. I know we're coming up on the hour, and so I'm just really grateful for you walking me through all of this. This was great for me personally, just like literally going from 10 days ago going, all right, I've seen this a million times. What the heck's an L2 voter file, to actually being able to talk to the person who's helping to run that is amazing. Yeah. And I'm really grateful to you and the team for getting together with me to explain it all.
Absolutely. My pleasure. I love to be able to talk about this in a way that's talking with a researcher. So it's great yes. to talk about
it. Was
it
a relief to not be asked any questions about your predictions for the outcome of an election? Do you get those kinds of questions?
Yes. All the time. Who's going to win? Mostly from my grandmother. And then I'm, who's going to win? Who's going to win? I'm like, I don't know. That's not what I do.
Exactly.
Crosstabs is hosted by me, Farah Bostic, with occasional help from Paul Saldera. Production by The Difference Engine and edited by me. Music from Audio Jungle by S Audio. You can subscribe to our weekly newsletter at crosstabspodcast.com. Tell your friends about the show, subscribe on your favorite podcast service, and if you want to learn more about what I do, you can find me on all the socials at Farah Bostic, or get in touch through thedifferenceengine.co. See you next time.